Chapter 45. It would be a classic understatement to say that Carl Wolf was horrified and enraged when he laid eyes on the broken wreckage of his aircraft. His grand scheme was in tatters, as he and his scientists and engineers milled around the hangar in fear and confusion. To his knowledge, the mechanism to break away the ice shelf was still set to come online in less than 4 minutes. Misguided by Hugo, who told them his guards at the control center were still locked in a life-or-death struggle with the Special Force teams, Carl had no perception that the Fourth Empire had died before it was born, or that Project Valhalla was aborted. The Wolves stood in a solemn group, unable to accept the full impact of the disaster, unable to believe the incredible story of a huge vehicle that had run amok and smashed their aircraft, before heading off toward the battle raging in front of the control center. They stood stunned with disbelief at the sudden reversal of their long-cherished plans. Hugo was the only one missing from his family members. Committed to the end, he had disregarded their predicament and was feverishly organizing the remaining members of his security force for the final resistance against the Americans he knew for certain were short minutes away from assaulting the hangar. Then Carl said, "Well, that's it then." He turned to Blondie. "Send a message to our brother Bruno on board the Ulrich Wolf. Explain the situation and tell him to send backup aircraft here immediately with all speed. We haven't another moment to lose." Blondie didn't waste time with questions. She took off at a run toward the radio inside the control room at the edge of the airstrip. "Will it be possible to land on the Ulrich Wolf during the early stages of the cataclysm?" Elsie Wolf asked her brother. Her face was pale with anguish. Carl looked at his chief engineer, Jürgen Holtz. "Do you have an answer for my sister, Jürgen?" A frightened Holtz looked down at the icy floor of the hangar and replied woodenly, "I have no way of calculating the exact arrival time of the expected hurricane winds and tidal waves, nor can I predict their initial strength. But if they reach the Ulrich Wolf before our flight can land, I fear the result can only lead to tragedy." "Are you saying we are all going to die?" demanded Elsie. "I'm saying we won't know until the time comes," Holt said soberly. "We'll never have time to transfer the Amini's artifacts from the damaged planes after Bruno arrives," said Carl, staring distraught at the family's personal executive jet, sitting broken like a child's toy. "We'll take only relics of the Third Reich. I'm going to need every able-bodied male and female who can shoot a weapon." The voice came from behind Carl. It was Hugo, whose black uniform was splattered with blood from the dead guard who'd failed to tell him of the havoc in the hangar. "I realize we have many frightened and disoriented people on our hands, but if we are to survive until rescued by our brothers and sisters at the shipyard, we must hold out against the American fighting force." "How many of your fighting men have survived?" asked Carl. "I'm down to 12. That's why I require all the reserves I can find." "Do you have enough weapons for us all?" Hugo nodded. "Guns and ammo can be found in the arsenal room at the entrance of the hangar." "Then you have my permission to recruit any and everyone who wants to see their loved ones again." Hugo looked his brother in the eyes. "It is not my place, brother, to ask them to fight and die. You are the leader of our new destiny. You are whom they respect and venerate. You ask, and they will follow." Carl stared into the faces of his brother and two sisters, seeing his own expression of foreboding in their eyes. With a mind as cold as an iceberg and a heart of stone, he had no misgivings about ordering his people to lay down their lives so that he and his siblings might survive. "Assemble them," he said to Elsie, "and I will tell them what they must do." Leaving four of his men who were not hurt seriously to tend the wounded and stand guard over the surviving security guards, Cleary and 22 able-bodied men of his remaining team, led by Pitt and Giordino, who knew the way to the hangar, entered the main tunnel in tactical formation, with two of Garnett's Delta Force acting as forward flanking scouts. Lieutenant Jacobs was more than surprised to meet up with Pitt and Giordino again, and even more amazed to find that they were the madmen who'd driven the snow cruiser into the battle zone only minutes before Cleary and his men would have ended up like Custer and the 7th Cavalry at the Little Bighorn. Moving cautiously, the column rounded the first bend in the tunnel and moved past the deserted construction equipment and the doorways leading into the empty storerooms. Walking through the ice tunnel seemed far different to Pitt and Giordino than when they had careened through it in the snow cruiser. Pitt smiled to himself at seeing the long gouges in the ice caused by his reckless driving when escaping the armored snowcat. When they reached an abandoned tow vehicle, attached to a small train of 4 flatbed cars that had been used to haul supplies and cargo throughout the tunnel labyrinth, they halted their advance and used the equipment for cover, as Cleary questioned Pitt and Giordino. "How far to the hangar from here?" he asked. "About another 500 yards before the tunnel opens into it," Pitt answered. "Is there any place between here and there they could set up a barricade?" "Every 10 feet, if they had the time and blocks of ice. But I doubt they could have built anything substantial in the few short minutes since they lost their battle for the facility." He pointed down on the ice. Besides the rotund indentations from the tires of the snow cruiser, the only other tracks came from a single snowmobile and the footprints of several men that suggested that they had been running from the battle. "Can't be more than a dozen security guards left. If they intend to mount a defense, it will have to be within 100 yards of the hangar." "Don't forget the snowcat," said Giordino quietly. "The one you didn't mash into scrap." "There's another one of those devilish vehicles still lurking around," growled Cleary. Pitt nodded. "Very well could be. What's in your traveling arsenal that can disable it?" "Nothing that will penetrate its armor," Cleary admitted. "Hold up your men, Major. I think I see something that might be of use." Pitt rummaged around in the toolbox of the tow vehicle until he came up with an empty fuel can. He found a steel pry bar and used it to perforate the top of the can. Then he took the bar and punched the bar through the bottom of the tow vehicle's fuel tank. When the can was full, he held it up. "Now all we need is an igniting device." Lieutenant Jacobs, who was observing Pitt's actions, reached into his pack and retrieved a small flare gun used for signaling purposes at night or in foul weather. "Will this do?" "Like a beautiful woman and a glass of fine Cabernet," said Pitt. Cleary raised his arm and swung it forward. "Let's move out." There were no haunting fears of the unknown now, no urgencies or trepidations. Flankers moving like cats, followed by men unshakable and committed, bent on avenging friends who'd died back at the control center. They advanced into the tunnel like wraiths under the obscure light refracting through the ice. Pitt felt a swell of pride, knowing that he and Giordino were accepted by such men as equals. Suddenly the flankers motioned a halt. Everyone froze, listening. An engine's exhaust faintly heard in the distance signaled the approach of a vehicle. Soon the sound grew louder and echoed through the tunnel. Then twin lights appeared, their beams dancing on the ice before rounding the bend. "The snowcat," Pitt announced calmly. "Here it comes." He pointed at one of the nearby empty storerooms. "I suggest you and your men get inside quickly before we're all exposed by the headlights." A terse, quiet command, and 20 seconds later every man was inside the storeroom, with the door cracked open an inch. The lights grew brighter as the snowcat tread its way through the tunnel. Just behind the storeroom door, Pitt crouched with the fuel can clutched in both hands. Behind him, Jacob stood poised and ready to fire the flare pistol, and behind him, The entire team primed and ready to pour from the storeroom and lay down a hail of lethal fire on the occupants of the Snowcat or any guards who might be following on foot. Timing was critical. If Pitt threw the can too soon or too late, and the guards inside survived, the entire Special Force team was trapped inside the storeroom like ducks in a closet, and would be wiped out in less time than it would take to tell about it. Jacobs had to be on target, too. A miss, and it was all over. The Snowcat came closer. Pitt judged its speed at about 10 miles an hour. The driver was moving cautiously. Through the narrow slit between the door and frame, he saw no sign of guards following the vehicle on foot. "She's coming too fast for support to follow behind," Pitt reported softly to Cleary. "My guess is they're on a scouting mission." "They carry 4 men," Cleary murmured. "I know that much." Pitt shifted his head and closed his eyes to keep from being temporarily blinded by the bright lights of the Snowcat. It was so close now, he could hear its treads crunch against the icy floor of the tunnel. With infinite caution, without using any sudden movement that might catch the eye of the vehicle's occupants, he inched the door open. The front end of the Snowcat was now close enough to the storeroom that he could hear the muted beat of its engine. Nimbly, focused, and precisely, he threw the door open, raised himself to his full height, and hurled the gas can into the open compartment of the Snowcat. Then, without the slightest suggestion of a pause, he ducked to his side and dropped to the ice. Jacobs was not one to let the grass grow under his feet. He was aiming the flare pistol before Pitt cast aside the door. A millimeter adjustment and he fired, the shell missing Pitt's head by the width of 2 fingers, a heartbeat after the fuel can sailed into the open Snowcat and splashed its contents inside. The interior erupted in a holocaust of flame. The horrified guards, their uniforms ablaze, leaped from the Snowcat and rolled frantically on the ice to smother the fire. Even if they had been successful, their lives would not have been spared. The men of Cleary's command, who had suffered so appallingly from the guards earlier, were not in a benevolent mood. They burst from the storeroom and put the guards out of their agony in a flurry of gunfire. The Snowcat, now hardly identifiable as a mechanical transport, lurched driverless through the tunnel, grazing the slick walls of ice that did little to slow it down. No time was spent inspecting the death scene. Cleary regrouped his men and got them moving again. Not one man turned and looked back or showed a sign of remorse. They pushed on through the tunnel, anxious to end the nightmare and punish those responsible. With a conscious effort of will, Pitt rose to his feet and leaned on Giardino's rock-strong shoulder for a few steps until his legs worked efficiently again, then set off after Cleary. When his radio calls to the Snowcat went unanswered and the sounds of gunfire reverberated from the tunnel, Hugo Wolf assumed the worst. With no more armored vehicles, he had one more hand to play before the Americans reached the hangar and engaged in another free-for-all battle with his 10 remaining security guards. He had little confidence in the small army of engineers, who hardly knew how to handle weapons or had the fortitude to shoot down another human, especially a trained professional who was shooting back. What he was about to attempt, Hugo thought morosely, was the last throw of the dice. He walked over to where Carl, Elsie, and Blundy were conversing with Jürgen Holtz. Carl turned and looked at Hugo, seeing the dark expression. "Problems, brother?" "I believe I have lost my last armored Snowcat and 4 men who were not expendable."
"We've got to hold out," said Elsie. "Bruno is on his way with 2 aircraft and is scheduled to arrive 5 hours from now."
3.5 hours after the ice shelf breaks free, Holtz remarked. "The activation sequence for the ice machines has begun, and there can be no stopping it." Carl swore softly. "Can we hold out until then?" Hugo stared at the tunnel leading to the mining facility as if he were expecting an army of phantoms. "They can't have but a handful of men left.
If my guards can eliminate them in the tunnel, or at least whittle them down to a pitiful few, then between the rest of us we easily have enough firepower to stop them for good." Carl faced Hugo and laid a hand on his shoulder. "Regardless of the outcome, brother, I know you will have conducted yourself bravely and with honor." Hugo embraced Carl, then moved off to join the last of his guards and lead them into the tunnel. They were followed by a tow vehicle pulling a flat car loaded with a 55-gallon drum and a large 6-foot diameter fan. The Special Forces team stopped short of the last bend in the tunnel before it straightened and ran another 50 yards into the hangar. A light mist appeared ahead that seemed to grow thicker as it rolled through the tunnel and began to envelop the men.
"What do you make of it?" Cleary asked Pitt.
"Nothing good. We encountered nothing like it when we passed through here with the snow cruiser." Pitt raised a finger as if testing for wind. "It's not a natural phenomenon. Not only does it have a strange smell, but it's being sent by some sort of mechanism, probably a large fan."
"Not poisonous," said Cleary, sniffing the mist.
"Part of our training is in recognizing toxic gas. My guess is they're laying a harmless chemical on us to screen their movements."
"Could be they're short on manpower and making a desperation play," suggested Jacobs, who came up alongside the major.
"Close up," Cleary ordered his men through his helmet radio. "We'll keep going. Be ready to take whatever cover you can find, should they advance and fire out of the mist."
"I don't recommend that course of action," Pitt warned him. Cleary simply asked, "Why?"
Pitt grinned at Giordino. "I think we've been here before."
"And done that," Giordino added.
Pitt stared appraisingly at the mist, then put his hand on Giordino's arm. "Al, take one of the major's men, run back to the tow vehicle, and bring back its spare tire."
Cleary's eyes reflected curiosity. "What good is a tire?"
"A little subterfuge of our own."
Minutes later, a tremendous detonation tore through the heart of the tunnel. No flame or swirling smoke, but a blinding flash followed by an enormous shock wave that crushed the confined air before it shot away like a missile through a pneumatic tube. The explosive sound came like a giant clap of thunder before it rumbled away and its echoes slowly faded. Very slowly, stunned by the sheer density of the shock, his ears ringing like cathedral bells, Hugo Wolf and his 10 security guards, four having been killed in the firebombing of the snowcat, staggered with numbed senses to their feet and began to advance through mounds of fallen ice, expecting to find nothing but the disintegrated bodies of the Americans. The sheer concussion was far beyond what they'd expected, but their hopes were buoyed into thoughts that their enemy had been eliminated. Rounding the bend and using flashlights to penetrate the remnant of the mist and vapors from the explosion, they slowly moved forward until they could distinguish bodies lying gruesomely in and under the ice dislodged from the tunnel's roof. Hugo's eyes wandered from figure to figure, satisfaction and elation rising inside him at the sight of the dead Americans. Not one had survived. He looked down at two men who were dressed as civilians and wondered who they were and where they had come from. They were lying face down, and he failed to recognize them as the two men who'd driven the abominable vehicle that had caused so much death and destruction at the control center.
"Congratulations on a great triumph, Mr. Wolf," one of his guards complimented him.
Hugo slowly nodded.
"Yes, but it was a triumph that came with too high a cost."
Then, mechanically, he and his men turned their backs on the seeming carnage and began walking back to the hangar.
"Freeze!" Cleary shouted.
Hugo and his men whirled around, aghast at seeing dead men suddenly leap to their feet with their guns leveled and trained. He might have surrendered then and there. Any sane man would have seen that resistance could only end in certain death. But Hugo, more on reflex than with a stable mind, threw up his gun to fire, the guards following his action. The Special Forces weapons roared as one. The security guards managed to fire only a few frenzied rounds before they were cut down. Hugo stumbled backward, stood motionless in his tracks, his face contorted as he dropped his gun and stared through shocked and glazed eyes at the neatly spaced bullet holes that crossed the stomach of his black uniform from chest to waist. Finally, with sick certainty that he had failed, and knowing he had only a few seconds to live, he crumpled to the ground. The gunfire had died away, and Jacobs, followed cautiously by his men, began inspecting the bodies and removing all weapons clutched in dead hands. Pitt, with his Colt hanging loosely in his right hand, came over and knelt at Hugo's side. The leader of the Wolf family's annihilated security force became aware of a presence and stared up expressionlessly.
"How did you know?" he murmured. "Your people used the same booby-trap trick on me in the mine in Colorado." "But the explosion?"
Pitt knew the man was going, and he had to get it in fast. "We rolled the spare tire and wheel from a tow vehicle down the tunnel, tripping the wire to your explosive charge. We then took cover in a storeroom. Immediately after the blast, we ran out and scattered ourselves in the ice debris caused by the concussion and played dead."
"Who are you?" he whispered.
"My name is Dirk Pitt." The eyes widened briefly.
"Not you," he whispered.
Then the eyes froze open, and his head slumped to the side.